At 11 hours Greenwich Mean Time, this is Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC with Louise Fryer. The headlines: the astronauts aboard the space station Mir have been holding urgent talks with Mission Control about tackling the damage caused in yesterday's collision. An independence leader in East Timor has died after being captured by the Indonesian authorities. A Japanese fishing boat has come under fire in the continuing dispute with Russia over islands off the northern Japanese coast. President Clinton has announced tough new controls on air pollution in the United States. Also in the next 30 minutes, the latest from Cambodia on the whereabouts of the former Khmer Rouge ruler Pol Pot, and optimistic words from Hong Kong's top financial official about the economic future under Chinese control. The crew of the Russian space station Mir have been talking to Mission Control about how to deal with the damage caused when a cargo spaceship crashed into Mir. The crew have been working without sleep to assess the damage, and they've had to work in the dark to conserve energy supplies. A solar panel, which generated almost half the station's electricity, was damaged in the accident. The astronauts have turned Mir so that its undamaged solar panels now face the sun. Here's our Moscow correspondent, Andrew Harding.
The three astronauts on board Mir have been working with an emergency commission back on Earth trying to figure out how to repair the space station. During one 20-minute exchange, the crew could be heard talking through various options with Russia's Mission Control. Should we switch on button B2? Yes, try it. What's the result? Not clear. Then try it again. The astronauts' most immediate problem is energy. The crash damaged a key solar panel, and the crew has been forced to switch off all non-essential equipment. A Russian cargo ship, due to be launched on Friday, will now almost certainly wait until a vital stretch of cable needed to repair Mir's power system can be delivered to the launch site. There may be more problems ahead, though. A Russian official said the loss of power would make it very difficult for the cargo ship to dock with Mir. Russian and American officials continue to insist that the crew is in no immediate danger. The British-born astronaut Michael Foal lost much of his equipment during the accident and has reportedly asked NASA to send up more supplies, including a new toothbrush.
Andrew Harding in Moscow. Indonesian military sources say one of the top commanders of the pro-independence movement in East Timor has died in their custody after being captured with five of his men. The commander, David Anix, is believed to have been involved in recent attacks by the pro-independence movement against the Indonesian armed forces. David Anix had been a veteran of the struggle against Indonesian rule since 1975, when Indonesia invaded the former Portuguese colony. The United Nations does not recognize Indonesian rule there. Jonathan Head reports from Jakarta.
According to the Indonesian military authorities, David Anix was captured with five of his colleagues near the town of Baucau in the east of the territory. They say he was shot in the hand and leg during the operation and died while being taken by helicopter to the capital, Dili. No independent sources have been allowed to see and identify the body, but if his death is confirmed, it would be a setback to the pro-independence movement at a time when it stepped up its campaign against Indonesian rule. During last month's election campaign, rebels launched their most ambitious attacks for at least a decade against military targets, government officials and polling stations. In one ambush, 18 members of a special police force were killed when their truck was struck by a grenade. David Anix is believed to have been behind many of those attacks. He was one of the veterans of the armed struggle against Indonesian rule who followed the pro-independence fighters to the mountains of East Timor in 1975 after Indonesian forces invaded the former Portuguese colony. He'd become something of a hero to many young Timorese, in much the same way as the former guerrilla commander Janana Gusmao, who was caught by the Indonesian military in 1992 and is now serving a 20-year prison sentence in Jakarta. But there are no signs yet that the desire for greater autonomy or independence among the Timorese has diminished, nor is Indonesia any closer to gaining international recognition for its annexation.
Jonathan Head in Jakarta. The Philippines armed forces say four Muslim separatists and two soldiers have been killed in the latest fighting on the southern island of Mindanao. The authorities also accused the guerrillas of taking about 100 passengers hostage when two buses were stopped at a guerrilla roadblock. But a rebel spokesman denied this, saying the passengers had been stranded by fighting between the army and guerrillas. John McLean reports from Manila.
The two sides in this scrappy war of secession in the southern Philippines can agree on only one thing, that guerrillas of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or MILF, set up a roadblock on a highway connecting the east and west of Mindanao and then stopped two buses. A spokesman for the armed forces says the guerrillas then took hostage about 100 civilian passengers. Reports in the Philippine media say a few dozen passengers subsequently escaped or were rescued by soldiers. But a spokesman for the MILF denied that his men had taken the passengers hostage. He said the bus passengers had simply been stranded as fighting between troops and guerrillas raged around them. The fighting was part of a battle that's been going on in the vicinity for more than a week. The armed forces have been attacking MILF positions in an attempt to root out a gang of armed robbers. The MILF denies that it's involved in armed robbery. But the battle has cost dozens of lives and has forced thousands of civilians to flee their homes. Because of the latest fighting, the MILF has demanded the postponement of peace talks it was due to have held with the government this weekend. The two sides were due to have discussed a general ceasefire as a first step towards a peace agreement. The MILF wants independence for the Muslim minority in the south of this predominantly Christian country, although the government believes the guerrillas will settle for Muslim autonomy.
John McLean in the Philippines. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. Japan has protested to Moscow after Russian border guards opened fire on four Japanese boats in waters near disputed islands off the northern coast of Japan. The Japanese Maritime Safety Agency said two crewmen aboard one of the vessels were wounded. Russian naval officials, quoted by the Interfax news agency, said earlier warning signals had been disregarded. The incident took place in dense fog near the group of four islands called the Northern Territories by Japan and the Southern Kuriles by Russia. Here's Juliet Hindle in Tokyo.
In dense fog, the Japanese trawler came under fire near one of four disputed islands off Japan's north coast. The Japanese Coast Guard says one crew member was seriously injured by a bullet in the thigh, and another was also slightly injured. They've both been taken to a Japanese hospital. According to the Russian news service Interfax, Russian naval authorities in Vladivostok said the Japanese boats were 14 kilometers inside Russian territorial waters. A coastal patrol ship gave the Japanese fishing boat sound and light warning signals and also warned the crew that they had crossed the border using an international radio channel. When they got no reaction, the Russian ship was forced to open warning fire. 25 minutes later, the Japanese boat left the area. The Russian authorities said there were no injuries. The Japanese Foreign Ministry said that if Russian vessels were involved, such an act against fishing boats could not be condoned. The islands are currently under Russian control and have been since 1945, but Japan still claims them. The dispute over the territories has stood in the way of a World War II peace treaty between the two countries. Russia has frequently accused Japanese fishing boats of poaching in the area.
Juliet Hindle in Tokyo. The Russian Prime Minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin, has arrived in China, where he's expected to sign several trade agreements, primarily concerning the energy sector. Mr. Chernomyrdin stopped first in the southern economic zone of Shenzhen. Later, he's due to travel to Beijing, where he'll meet his Chinese counterpart, Li Peng, and President Jiang Zemin on Friday. From Beijing, here's Carrie Gracie.
After decades of rivalry for ideological leadership of the socialist world, China and Russia are now the most pragmatic of neighbors. On the diplomatic front, annual presidential summits and declarations of strategic partnership underline a commitment to cooperate on the world stage. But despite the natural advantage of a 4,000-kilometer border and reasonably complementary economies, business has not kept pace with the political climate. Bilateral trade is worth less than $7 billion a year, and repeated pledges by both governments to do better have made little difference. Russian hopes are pinned on the power industry. With Chinese growth rates averaging 10% a year, the country has an insatiable demand for energy. And in the oil and gas fields of Siberia, Russia believes it has the supply. For several years, the two governments have been negotiating over joint development of a natural gas field in Irkutsk and a pipeline through China to supply Japan and South Korea. During Mr. Chernomyrdin's visit this week, the two sides are expected to sign a framework agreement on the project. Energy aside, Russia's most promising export to China is weaponry. Officials from Russia's arms export company are traveling with Mr. Chernomyrdin on this visit, and they may be hoping for new contracts in a partnership which offers Russia significant export revenues and gives China access to the kind of sophisticated weaponry which Western governments still refuse to sell it.
Carrie Gracie in Beijing. The family of the prominent Chinese dissident Wei Jingsheng says he's been severely beaten by other inmates at the prison where he's serving a 14-year jail term after being accused of conspiring to subvert the government. The family are quoted by the New York-based group Human Rights in China as saying that inmates at Tangshan Prison were told they could get reduced sentences if they attacked him. They said there'd been a number of attacks and that they'd seriously damaged Mr. Wei's already poor health. There's been no independent confirmation of the report. Reports from Thailand say the leader of the Cambodian Khmer Rouge movement, Pol Pot, is alive and is being held prisoner by a group of his former comrades. There's no independent confirmation of the reports, although earlier this week a Cambodian Defence Ministry official said he'd seen Pol Pot at a Khmer Rouge base in the jungle near the Cambodian-Thai border. From the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, Enver Solomon reports.
This is the first detailed information from the Thai army about the whereabouts of Pol Pot. A senior military official said that the leader of the Khmer Rouge was being held by a group of guerrillas who turned against him. He said Pol Pot was very sick and had to be given oxygen. This report from the Thai military is in line with details which the Cambodian government has been giving reporters about the fate of the guerrilla leader. On Monday, a senior defence official said he'd seen Pol Pot in the guerrillas' remote jungle base in northern Cambodia. But since then, there's been no new information from the government in Phnom Penh. Defence officials were expecting the guerrillas' clandestine radio station to declare its allegiance to the government, but this hasn't happened. Getting an accurate picture of the whereabouts of Pol Pot and his comrades is extremely difficult, because it's virtually impossible to get any independent information from the remote region close to the Thai border where the Khmer Rouge is based. But despite this, it's becoming increasingly clear that the Khmer Rouge has split into rival factions, following an open disagreement over its future strategy. Some senior Khmer Rouge leaders believe the only way the guerrilla movement can survive is to have a role in mainstream Cambodian politics, and they're eager to negotiate a deal with the government. But it's still uncertain whether this will happen, and there are no firm indications yet that the Khmer Rouge is on the verge of total collapse.
Enver Solomon in Cambodia. Coming later in Newsdesk, new hope in the battle to eradicate the disease polio. Now, a reminder of our main headline. Russian and American space officials have been holding emergency talks with the crew of the Russian Mir space station to work out how to repair the damage caused when an unmanned cargo craft crashed into the station yesterday. The film of the damage revealed that the collision had left a hole several centimetres wide in part of the station and had destroyed part of a solar panel used for generating electricity. President Clinton has announced plans for tough new controls on air pollution in the United States on the eve of his speech later today to the United Nations Earth Summit in New York. The new rules will force American industry to lower its output of soot and smog over 10 years. The announcement follows strong criticism of America as the biggest polluter on the planet. Philippa Thomas reports from Washington.
President Clinton's announcement has been enthusiastically welcomed by environmental groups, who say that this is a major step forward in promoting public health. The new initiative proposes tighter controls on emissions of ozone and of soot particles, which are mainly caused by burning fuels. One green group said the higher standards would protect 5 million American children who suffer from asthma. And the White House says they will prevent around 15,000 premature deaths each year. Speaking at a conference in Tennessee, Mr. Clinton employed his favorite family values language when he told his audience that he knew the regulations would be somewhat controversial, but kids ought to be healthy. The president is aware, however, that he faces furious opposition from powerful business interests such as oil, mining and utility companies, and from state governments which fear the new high standards will devastate their local economies. They've been conducting a year-long lobbying battle in Washington against the new clean air rules, and they've vowed to keep up the pressure as the regulations make their way through Congress.
Philippa Thomas in Washington. The Peruvian government says it's to improve the living conditions of most prisoners who've been jailed on terrorism charges. Under the new rules, prisoners will, among other things, be able to receive weekly visits from their families. On Wednesday, the government also freed more than 100 prisoners who it says were unjustly jailed as a result of tough anti-terrorist legislation. Prison conditions and releases of prisoners were among the issues raised by the Tupac Amaru guerrillas, who stormed the Japanese ambassador's residence in Peru last December. The Peruvian Foreign Minister, Francisco Tudela, has told the United States ambassador in Lima, Dennis Jett, that it's unacceptable for foreign diplomats to comment on Peru's internal affairs. Mr. Tudela said he was extremely unhappy with comments made by Mr. Jett criticizing Peru's purchase of 12 warplanes from Belarus. The ambassador said on Tuesday that the money used to pay for just one of the aircraft could have built 400 schools in rural areas. Doubts have also been raised about whether the planes will ever be ready for combat, since Belarus is unable to provide maintenance and spare parts. The president of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, Zoran Lilic, has stepped down following the expiry of his term in office. He's been replaced by a temporary successor until elections to the post are held within the next 30 days. The BBC Belgrade correspondent says the current president of Serbia, Slobodan Milosevic, is expected to win the election with ease and move to strengthen the power the Yugoslav president wields. Our correspondent says Mr. Milosevic's main priorities will be to maintain control of the police and the state media. He's barred from seeking a third term as president of Serbia. The World Health Organization says it believes it can meet its target of eradicating polio by the year 2000. The goal was originally established in 1988. Our correspondent in Geneva, Owen Bennett-Jones, reports that great progress has been made since then in the battle against the disease.
Since 1988, the incidence of polio around the world has fallen by 90%. Last year, there were just 3,800 recorded new cases. The huge reduction in polio incidence has been achieved in large part by national immunisation days. Earlier this year, in India, for example, 127 million children were vaccinated in one day. It's hoped that achievement will help further improve the situation in India, where 1,000 people caught the disease last year. Other countries which still have significant numbers of polio cases are Pakistan and Egypt. But in all these places, the number of cases being reported nowadays is tiny when compared to the situation before the polio vaccine was developed. Then, some 500,000 people each year were paralysed or died after contracting the disease. While the WHO remains hopeful that polio will be eradicated by the year 2000, it says that some serious challenges do remain, especially in countries experiencing severe political turmoil or civil war. The WHO says that there have been recent war-related outbreaks of polio in Chechnya, and it's fearful that some areas which have nearly shaken off the disease could see it re-emerge.
Owen Bennett-Jones. An earthquake has hit northeastern Iran, and according to the Iranian news agency, 15 villages have been destroyed. There were no immediate reports of casualties. The news agency said the quake in Khorasan province measured more than 6 on the Richter scale. It said relief teams from the Red Crescent Society had been sent to the area. An earthquake in the same region last month killed about 2,000 people and left 50,000 homeless. The foreign ministers of Egypt, Syria and 6 Gulf Arab states have agreed to set up a common market. The ministers, gathered in the Syrian coastal town of Latakia, said a committee would meet in September to prepare the necessary measures. No date was given for the start of the market, which ministers described as a first step towards the economic integration of members of the Arab League. The 8 countries are linked by the Damascus Declaration, which they signed in 1991 after supporting the American-led coalition to liberate Kuwait from Iraqi occupation. The British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook is going to Luxembourg today to urge other European Union governments to scale down their representation at some of the ceremonies inaugurating Chinese rule in Hong Kong. Britain and the United States have already said they'll be sending diplomats rather than politicians to the swearing-in of the new legislature next week. Britain wants other states to back pressure to maintain political freedoms in Hong Kong, such as fair and open elections. In Hong Kong itself, the Legislative Council, which is to be abolished by China, has urged Beijing to speed up the process of democratizing the electoral system. Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason reports from the colony.
Many would regard the vote by the Legislative Council as a futile gesture, since the body elected in 1995 under a system opposed by China is about to be abolished. A resolution proposed by a member of the Democratic Party urged the Chinese government to amend its constitution for Hong Kong, the basic law, so as to achieve as soon as possible the election of the legislature by universal suffrage. This is, in fact, already laid down in the basic law as an ultimate objective. But the present timetable makes clear that even in the year 2003, only half the members of the council would be directly elected. That presupposes that new elections are held soon. The immediate result of the handover will be that a provisional legislature, essentially appointed by China, will take over. Britain is pressing its European Union partners to make a unanimous call for fair and open elections to be held in Hong Kong within a year. The United States is expected to push a similar line during the handover. It seems likely, though, that a new electoral system, still to be decided but probably involving multi-member seats, will considerably reduce the influence of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement.
Barnaby Mason. The chief financial official in Hong Kong, Sir Donald Chang, says prospects for the territory's economy look good after the handover. Sir Donald said he was occasionally concerned about speculative money pouring into Hong Kong, but he didn't believe that the now soaring stock market would crash. Sir Donald also dismissed speculation about possible disagreements between top civil servants and the incoming leadership. He was speaking to our Hong Kong correspondent, James Miles.
Until February, when it was announced that all of Hong Kong's top officials eligible to do so would be allowed to keep their jobs after the handover, there was widespread speculation that the financial secretary, Sir Donald Chang, might be dropped. This was because of his strong support for the governor, Chris Patten. In a BBC interview, the newly knighted Sir Donald said it was very reassuring that top officials and judges would be staying on. He said he was sure these people would continue to practice what they believed was right for Hong Kong. Sir Donald also played down China's decision to scrap the elected legislature and replace it with a Beijing-appointed interim body pending fresh elections, a decision that's angered some local politicians and Western governments.
I'm totally for the legislature which is in place, but I will have to work through the legislature, the new legislature from 1st July onwards, because unfortunately, through the disagreement of the two sovereigns, we have seen this minor dislocation. But it is not insurmountable.
Sir Donald said he'd be 100% loyal to Hong Kong's first post-colonial leader, Tung Chee Hwa. Despite persistent reports in Hong Kong of tension between Mr. Tung and top civil servants, Sir Donald said he did not foresee any difficulty for the civil service in working with Mr. Tung, a man whom he described as a friend for many years. The financial secretary was also upbeat about Hong Kong's economic prospects, saying that as the handover approached, all the omens were good. He said that the soaring stock market was, as he put it, solid, and that he did not believe it would go haywire.
James Miles. And now the latest financial figures. London's 100 share index is up 10 at 46.50. In Tokyo, the Nikkei average fell 54 to 20,624. The dollar is worth 1 German mark 72 and 113 Japanese yen, and the pound is valued at $1.66. The Russian First Deputy Prime Minister Anatoly Chubais has announced that funds have been transferred to Russia's regions to clear the backlog of unpaid pensions. Mr. Chubais told a government meeting in Moscow that around $477 million had been made available. He appealed to officials in the regions to make sure the pension arrears were paid by the end of the month, and he said banks would remain open over the coming weekend to enable this to take place. In March, more than 1 million people across Russia took part in demonstrations to protest against unpaid pensions and wages. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. It's now 11:24 Greenwich Mean Time.